Like a woman 42 weeks pregnant, a book past its due date, or a long-needed visit between friends, this is Overdue with The Slut and the Prude.
A bi-monthly feminist podcast that highlights the beauty of libraries while discussing everything from politics to pop culture and whatever nonsense pops into our heads.
No mistakes this time in the intro.
We're getting there.
We're in our second season. Year and a half.
It's just one of those things. Sometimes it comes, sometimes it goes. Sometimes I'm like, where am I? What am I doing?
Yeah. And sometimes you do the intro so many times that it doesn't sound right anymore. But on that note, welcome back, everybody. This is our second installment of the Black History Month podcasts. And it'll be the last one for the month, just because this is actually going to come out after February's over. Mm-hmm. But it just kind of sticks it to everybody that Black History Month is every month, just like history is every month. And Black History should be celebrated anytime it's made.
Exactly.
Actually, on that note, I wanted to kind of, make a statement or like put out a thought for people and to hear what you think about this as well. Mm-hmm. I think it's really telling and really interesting that we call it kind of Black History Month, and we're talking about, you and I are talking about, you know, Black Indigenous people of color and the history they're making, or them in history. Mm-hmm. But a lot of what we're talking about, even today when we talk about our different people, we're talking about it very much from a what makes history colonist perspective. Mm-hmm. Right? Because, like, we talked about last week, like, the first Black nurse.
Yeah.
Well, Black people and, you know, Indigenous people all of the world have been nurses.
Right.
All throughout history without having to be acknowledged as being nurses. Mm-hmm. We were just discussing what a nurse, like, the first nurse in terms of a graduate school with a graduate diploma and all that kind of thing. And I think it's just interesting and should be acknowledged that we understand that people of color have been making their own history for thousands of years.
Right.
And that we know that this isn't like she wasn't the first nurse ever who was a person of color.
Yeah.
We know that knowledge and history is only written by the quote-unquote winner of a war, and obviously in terms of Black history, unfortunately it's the colonists who are writing the history. And so I just kind of wanted to make that statement, because I was thinking about it all the last like week and a half since we posted it, and since we recorded, I was just thinking about that, because I think it's important to acknowledge.
Yeah, and that was a very interesting argument with Mary Seacole, who also happened to be a nurse, but unlike the one that you mentioned, she wasn't actually formally trained, and so when it came time to like revisit the curriculum for England, especially that MP guy was like, well, she's not really a nurse because she wasn't actually trained, and it was like, screw you, yes she was. No, she had no like formal education in terms of like what Western society deems appropriate for, you know, those vocations, but she was trained in healing by her mother, and she knew all about home remedies that were brought up in, you know, Jamaican culture. She'd go to London and did learn about the modern medicine that was practiced there, even though, like, you know, how modern was it actually? But so she put all of her experience together, and even then it wasn't quote good enough to be considered a nurse because she didn't have like an MD behind her name or didn't go to Oxford or whatever. But yeah, and there's lots of examples of that throughout history of people who were nurses or healers or whatever, but probably were not given those titles at that time or even now because they didn't have any kind of formal education. They didn't go to Oxford or Harvard or have something that they could hang on their wall.
Yeah, nothing that could be kind of traced in a way, in a Western way anyway. And I mean, even today we're starting to understand that so much knowledge has been lost because of that expectation of diploma or like of that piece of paper. Yeah. So much Indigenous knowledge, so much historical knowledge has been lost because of that. Yeah. One, because it's been wiped off the face of the planet purposefully. Mm-hmm. But two, because it was ignored mm-hmm. in science as a true knowledge, you mm-hmm. know? And so, yeah, it's something that's been playing on my mind since we recorded, and I just wanted to kind of just like have it be known and have it be discussed. Yeah. And have everybody else who's listening think about it as well. Mm-hmm. Think about, be introspective on what you consider to be history and what you consider to be anecdotal. Mm-hmm. Because Indigenous communities all over the world don't have a book full of their history, right? But that doesn't make their history any less true mm-hmm. or real
right.
than what is written in a book and taught academically. Mm-hmm. So.
And a lot of the information about Indigenous and Black people that are put in a book, of course, are also from the narrative of the person who's writing them, which are not mm-hmm. usually Aboriginal or Black people.
No.
And so you also have to kind of come at it from that perspective and ask yourself, what is it that the person is trying to convey in their writing? What is the purpose behind their writing? Mm-hmm. And kind of subliminally the messages that they hold or the biases that mm-hmm. they hold in writing it, right? Mm-hmm. And so when they talk about, like, ooh, the anecdotal knowledge of the Aboriginal people when they mm-hmm. pass down their stories, blah, 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 you know, that's very belittling. And that was actually the way in which they taught their histories. Mm-hmm. Not because they were, you know, stupid Native Americans who couldn't write. It's because that's the way that they did it.
That was the way that made the most sense to them. Yeah. That was the way that most communities outside of what you would call the Western mm-hmm. communities and the kind of quote-unquote first world,
yeah.
that's how most communities pass on their knowledge. Mm-hmm. Right? It was always through verbal.
Yeah.
And, I mean, when you're talking or thinking about anything, mm-hmm. even what someone says to you, what you read, what you see on TV, it's really important in all those aspects
yeah.
to do as Nora said and to think about who is writing it, why is it being written, mm-hmm. and what is it that that person is trying to convey
yeah.
and then additionally think about what biases are present
mm-hmm.
both in the person writing it
mm-hmm.
and in the platform it's being
mm-hmm.
put upon.
Because mm-hmm.
one person could write a different article for, let's put it into a modern context, could write one article for the news, write one script for a YouTube video, and write one post for an Instagram, all on the same topic, and they're all going to come across very differently.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are for three different audiences. Theoretically, they could be trying to push three different angles of the story.
Yeah.
The same author. And also, each platform is structured differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has to be given a different way, which can be then received in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So history is, in and of itself, was and has been for a long time, especially the stuff taught here in North America and what we're able to access kind of on the internet, has predominantly been written by rich, white men.
Yeah.
And so it's important to understand in what context they will be speaking from.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we move forward with talking about our people this week,
mm-hmm.
It's important for us to remember as your podcast hosts, but also for you as our listeners to remember that the information we're trying to read, we're trying to talk about it through that lens,
yeah.
while also trying to unpack our own mm-hmm. biases,
mm-hmm.
which is something that I know I was taught in school and a lot of people are taught in university, but it's still impossible to get rid of all your biases.
Oh, especially because the biases are ingrained for me since, like, grade one. The minute you start learning history, the minute it's part of your being, it's already biased.
Yep.
And, you know, the schools have a certain angle in which they're trying to push to you. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the books that you read have an angle, and your parents mm-hmm. have an angle, and everybody's coming at you with all different angles, and they all have their own yep. biases, so.
And then you're going to have your own bias as well, one that you're kind of just like, you might have seen it on a TV show. Yeah. And then it doesn't matter what everyone else is throwing at you. So yeah, I just understand that everybody is biased. Yeah. You have to really, really work to unpack your bias. Mm-hmm. And then once you've unpacked it, you've got to work really, really hard to decide then what your new bias is going to be. Mm-hmm. Because you could unpack it and leave it at that and understand, oh yeah, I'm a bigoted, you know, whoever. But once you've figured that out, you can just stop. And that's where a lot of history kind of does. Yeah. It kind of goes, oh yeah, I'm bigoted. And I'm just going to keep writing. So do you want to start us off or should I?
Whatever you would like.
I'll start off then. So this week, or this episode, is about Black and Indigenous people of color who are writers. Mm. We figure, since this is a podcast about libraries and a podcast about books, we should probably talk about people who write them. And so I guess I'll start off. My woman of color that I'd like to talk about today is Phyllis Wheatley. She was born in 1953. Nope, that's the wrong date. 1753 to 1784. So she did die when she was only like 31, which is...
Oh my goodness.
Not very old at all. But I think as I read her story, maybe it'll make a little bit more sense. So she was enslaved and educated by a very prominent enslaver named John Wheatley. So she was born into slavery, or into enslavement. Mm-hmm. And throughout her life, she was educated kind of alongside his children, because she was kind of sickly, not very strong, mm-hmm. I guess is the best way to put it. And so rather than being put to work like many of the other people he enslaved, he taught her kind of alongside his children. And
well, that's very generous.
She ended up. Yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking. It was very interesting
dynamic. Maybe there was a familial relation there.
You would think maybe, right? Because it was, it doesn't say exactly why or what happened. But later you'll see, I think, why he ended up doing it. Mm. So basically, she was taught how to read and write. She was taught geography, the Bible, astronomy, literature, and was found to be quite proficient and excelled quite a lot at writing, specifically writing poetry. Mm-hmm. So she was a poet. Now, in 1770, she published her first poem was published, her first set of poems was published. It had 28 poems in it. And a lot of her works were actually used as a catalyst for many fledgling anti-enslavement movements, mm-hmm. because a lot of the people who were trying to push for anti-enslavement were trying to push against the rhetoric that people of color weren't smart and weren't capable of learning. That was a lot of the rhetoric mm-hmm. around like why people wanted to keep people of color enslaved. Yeah. And so a lot of her work was used as kind of proof of the fact that, you know, people of color were just as intelligent, just as capable of learning mm-hmm. as any white person was. Mm-hmm. And so by kind of 1773, she was a household name in London where she was published. Mm-hmm. She wasn't able to be published very much in North America mm-hmm. because people didn't want to read a Black person's writing.
Nobody wants to hear what a slave has to say.
Basically, nobody wanted to hear what an enslaved person had to say, especially because she wrote a lot about her experiences about racism and exclusion and kind of life, and so no one wanted to hear any of that. Now, here's where the kicker is. She was paraded around by John Wheatley as, like, a black person who could write throughout London. And her, like, books were kind of paraded around, and, like, she was, like, brought before, like, groups. I didn't really understand what group of people it was, but, like, she was presented to, like, editorials and the London press. Yeah. And kind of, like, as kind of, like, look at this enslaved girl who knows how to write and read and, like, look at the profound words that she can write.
Can we see my slideshow?
And so, yeah, and so that's why it's, like, people argued throughout her life and after her life when they talk about her about how, like, she may not have experienced the demands of labor and the harsh reality faced by those who are born in enslavement, but, like, she definitely, like, she wasn't treated as his children were treated. She was just kind of educated beside them. And unfortunately, so she was released from enslavement when the Wheatleys died. However, even though she didn't face the harsh realities of an enslaved person, kind of in terms of labor when she was with the Wheatleys, once she was released, she did end up living her life in poverty without any support due to racism and exclusion faced by those who are freed from enslavement. She died in December 5th, 1784, after living kind of in poverty, without able to find work because she wasn't very physically fit, and without any supports for her, she did end up dying kind of by herself. She had a husband, I believe, but he kind of left to try to work, and I believe ended up passing away because of it. She ended up writing 145 poems. Many were used by abolitionists to prove and prove. Oh my god. Many were used by abolitionists as proof and to condemn, you know, institutional enslavement and to basically undermine the practice, like undermine the very reason people said it was okay to have people enslaved. So she, from what I can tell, and what I read, would be considered the very first published person of color. Because she was a published writer, even if it was kind of through a white person's means. Which I thought for our podcast today made a lot of sense to kind of bring it all back. And so the very first published piece of work by a person of color was poetry, and she wrote a lot of poetry.
That's such a sad life.
I know. When I was reading it over, I was really, really saddened by her experience, and just, like, that she obviously lived, she probably knew the luxury of living as, like, next to her enslaver's children, and then was given this freedom. Finally, after all this hard work, after being paraded around like some sort of, I don't know, pet, and then kind of, I don't know, suffered for it, suffered for her freedom, and it just, it was really sad to read.
Well, we're off to a cheery start this week.
Yeah.
And we're going to continue with that cheeriness with the next one that I want to mention.
Yeah.
I talked about him briefly last year. The book that I was reading about was one of our from the Dropbox mentions, and that is Thomas Alexander Dumas. He had a bit of a tragic end as well. So he was born on the island of St. Dominique on March 25th, 1765, to a lesser French nobleman named Alexandre Antoine Davy. He was the Marquis de la Pelletière and a black slave woman. You must excuse my French. I did not do very well in my studies. So I will be butchering a lot of this. And so any French speakers, please forgive me. In 1772, he returned to France and eventually moved to Paris, where he enjoyed the financial support of his father, who was actually a marquis. So, if you remember from last year when I spoke about him, his father was a real character. He actually sold his mother and siblings once returned to France.
And, oh my God.
Yeah. And, loaned his favorite son out. So that.
Oh!
He didn't sell.
His favorite son?
His favorite son, that was Alexander. He loaned him out. He didn't outright sell him, because that way he could never get him back. But yeah, he loaned him to another man.
Oh my lord. Oh my god.
That's what
okay.
you get for being the favorite, where you get put on loan. So he joined the French army in 1786, enlisting under his mother's name, Marie Dumas, in order to preserve the family's reputation. A lot of noblemen actually went into the army and they became like colonels and all those high-ranking officers. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to start from the bottom. And his father's like, you're not disgracing me like that. So you want to be that? You got to use your different name. He's like, okay, fine. And so during the French Revolution, he became a devout Republican, serving in an all-black unit known as the Légion Américaine. He rose to the rank of a general at the age of 31, the highest rank of any black man in a European army. In 1797, he distinguished himself at the Battle of Adige, where he surprised and defeated an Austrian battery. He followed Napoleon to Egypt in 1798, but a lot of disagreements between he and Napoleon and his poor health ended him leaving early from that campaign. He departed in 1799, and upon returning home, he was shipwrecked off the Italian port of Taranto, where he was imprisoned for 2 years.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. So that was fun. All he did was he got shipwrecked, and then they kind of, like, imprisoned him for being there. You know, right. War times, as everything's all hoopy, so. Well, he was eventually released in 1801, and sailing home after having lost all of his possessions, he spent his last years recovering from his time as a prisoner, offering his services more once again to Napoleon and the army, but waiting in vain to be reinstated. And sadly, 2 years after being released from prison, he passed away. Very sad.
Wow.
Yeah. Tragic end to a very heroic man. But the reason that we're starting off with him is because as a relatively free man, he was loaned out for a period, but after that he was free. He went off and had...
Oh, thank God.
He married and had children and started a very long line of writers that followed him. So I'm not totally
good.
Off my case by reporting him. I'm following with the writer theme here. And so his surviving son, I don't know if he had other children, I think he did. But anyway, his son, worth noting, I'm sure they're all worth noting, but the one that I'm going to note about is Alexandre Dumas Père, which is known as Father. So he was born on July 24th, 1802, in Villers-Cotterêts, France. I am butchering this, okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I apologize to everybody who speaks French. Anyway. So his mother worked really hard to provide for him an education, which was probably not very easy for her.
Mm-mm.
And he attended Abbe Grégoire's school before dropping out to take a job as an assistant at a local notary. In 1822, he moved to Paris and immersed himself in the literature, began writing plays and comedies and dramas, and was a prolific writer of essays, short stories, and novels, as well as travelogues.
Mm-hmm.
He achieved widespread success with the novels The Count of Monte Cristo, The Three Musketeers, mm-hmm. which is very familiar and is actually said to probably be based off his father's time. Just his image of the father is what he is rumored to be the inspiration for The Count of Monte Cristo. And actually, you can actually see that because I think The Count of Monte Cristo, he's in prison, isn't he? And then comes
I
back.
I believe so.
And then seeks revenge, which is very reminiscent of what happened to his father.
Very reminiscent.
Unfortunately, his father never got the revenge he so adequately deserved. But that's where fiction, you know, can take you to different places. He penned a fantasy novel called The Wolf Leader, which is considered one of the earliest werewolf-themed books.
Whoa, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, and his popularities of his writings made him a household name in France and a celebrity throughout much of Europe. With the money that he earned, he purchased land and built the Chateau de Monte Cristo in Port Marly-Yvelines, France, which is now a museum. He died on December 5th, 1870, and was buried in the cemetery of Villers-Courtais in 2002. He was moved to the Pantheon of Paris to rest among his other French literary greats. So at the time, he wasn't able to be buried there because he was black. Right. But in 2002, they're like, screw that. He was a great literary art man, so he gets to be honored amongst them.
That's awesome.
His work has actually been translated into more than 100 languages and adapted into a multitude of movies.
Oh, that's cool. Imagine telling him that when he was writing.
Mm-hmm. So a great man sired a great son, who then sired another great son named, very originally, you would think you'd come up with a better name considering he was a writer, Alexander.
Oh, gosh.
Alexander Fil, which means son. Because, you know, you have to distinguish them some way.
Yeah.
So he was born July 27th, 1824, in Paris, France, to Alexander de Moss, of course, and his mistress, dressmaker Marie-Laure Catherine Labbé. So in 1831, once his play started making sizable income, his father's play, took full custody of him and sent him to the College Bourbon. So for some reason, his father was kind of a dick and was like, I'm not taking custody of you until I have some money, but okay.
Okay.
He could have been a dad throughout that whole time, but whatever. No judgment. Maybe a little judgment. So, after his schooling, he attempted verse and wrote some notable novels. However, his career didn't really take off until he tried his hand at dramas. So, troubled by his own birth status, his mother inspired many of his sympathetic portrayals of women, whether they were abandoned, unwed, or the epitome of the fallen woman. And so that's a kind of a theme throughout a lot of his writings.
Right.
And many of his plays dominated French theaters. He's best known today for his autobiography called Camille, which has been translated into dozens of languages and inspired numerous adaptations to the stage and film. In 1874, he was admitted to the Académie Française and in 1894 was awarded the Legion of Honor. He died on 27th November. He died on November 27th, 1895.
Wow.
So a lot of great writers coming from that family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess if you grow up with your, like, parent doing that, then the likelihood is you're going to be probably interested in that. Mm-hmm. But also, at the time period, if your parent can write and write well enough to publish, then the likelihood is you're going to be educated to write and write well.
And so, not only do we have, like, one great black writer who is making, you know, his way and being recognized during that time, but then you also have a son as well, and that's very accomplished, especially for people who most only think of them as enslaved individuals. And so you have like three generations of free black men contributing to their society and actually doing it well.
Amazing.
And we have one more female, just to round it out, named Mary Ann Schott, who was the first black female publisher.
Oh!
So, born in October 9th, 1823 in Delaware, which was a slave state, she was born to free parents and was the eldest of 13 children. My goodness.
Wow.
Her home was considered a safe house or a station on the Underground Railroad. So a lot of her activity and activism kind of came from the fact that her parents were a bit of activists themselves, helping enslaved individuals free themselves along the Underground Railroad, helping them get to freedom. So in September 10th, 1851, she attended the first North American Convention of Colored Freemen, held outside the U.S., delegates came to encourage enslaved Americans and refugees from enslavement to enter Canada a year before the U.S. had actually passed the Fugitive Slave Act, which essentially said that anybody who had caught their enslaved, slave, was able mm-hmm. to actually bring them back regardless of whether or not they were actually in a state that did not have slavery.
Oh.
So they were trying to encourage enslaved individuals to kind of come up to Canada to kind of get their freedom. Mm-hmm. So at the convention, she met Henry and Mary Bibb, who were activists and publishers of the newspaper called The Voice of the Fugitive. They convinced her to take a position in their home in Sandwich, Canada West, which is now Windsor, Ontario, as a teacher. She taught for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. So in 1851, she actually set up a racially integrated school that was open to all who could afford it, as the school was actually opened with financial help from the American Missionary Association. So at the time, school was only to those who could actually afford it. It was not universal. So if you could afford to go to the school, you were able to do so. She wrote educational booklets that outlined the advantages of Canada for settlers moving north, including A Plea of Immigration or Notes of Canada West that was published in 1852. Unfortunately, her school lost funding shortly after a dispute between her and the Bibbs, as she was she was against segregated schools, and they, of course, were in favor.
Of course they were.
And so this ended up with a lot of, like, tit for tat and kind of quibbling with each other over in the newspapers, and eventually they're just like, well, screw it, we're not going to fund your school anymore.
Of course they.
To promote immigration to Canada, she publicized the success of Black persons living in freedom in Canada through the Provincial Freeman, a weekly newspaper that was first printed on March 24, 1853, making her the first woman in North America to publish a newspaper and one of the first female journalists. She, however, didn't list her own name on the paper's masthead and never took credit for any article she wrote. I'm not sure why. Hmm. Modest, I guess. Or maybe she just didn't want the attention. Who knows?
Yeah.
So the paper figured prominently anti-slavery authors and even promoted women's rights. It was published from Windsor from 1853 to 1854, from Toronto from 1854 to 1855, and Chatham in 1855 to 1857. By 1860, however, it had succumbed to financial pressure and folded.
Right.
And after a few years as a school teacher in Chatham, she returned to the U.S. and worked as a recruitment agent for the Union Army. Later, she would work as a teacher in Washington, D.C., and pursued law studies at Harvard, becoming one of the first Black women to complete a law degree in 1883. In 1994, she was recognized as a person of a national historic and significance by the Government of Canada, and for her work as a newspaper editor and community leadership. In October of last year, it gets better, she was actually featured as a Google Doodle for her 197th birthday.
Oh!
It honored her legacy as the first Black female newspaper publisher in North America and her advocacy for the abolition of slavery and women's rights. She died on June 5th, 1893 in Washington, D.C.
Wow. Mm-hmm. What a lady.
Yeah. And so I actually wanted to deviate slightly, not to poo-poo on this woman's work, because she did phenomenal work. But I think it's equally important to note that while she was trying to get people to come up to Canada, and she was promoting mm-hmm. how great it was and all the wonderful successes Black people had up in Canada, it is important to note that Canada does have a very sketchy history with slavery.
And yes, it does.
It's not well known. We are very good at hiding our slave
past. We are, unfortunately.
Yes, and so while it talks about the Underground Railroad, and a lot of people think about Canada as kind of like the safe haven, the beacon, you know, the utopia for enslaved Americans running away, going up to Canada, freedom, yay! That's kind of the narrative that we push to the world. And aren't we so great? Not like our Southern brother, if you are, you know. Mm.
That, outwardly and openly racist.
Yes. They're like, we're not like that. We were the safe haven. We were the beacon. We were the...
You know what? You're right. We're not openly and outwardly racist. We hide our racism really well.
We do. It's the fact that most people don't even know that Canada had slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And a great book that I'm currently reading that talks about the history of slavery in Canada is actually called The Hanging of Angelique by Afua Cooper. And in it, she writes, Canada might not have been a slave society, that is, a society whose economy was based on slavery, but it was a society with slaves. The earliest era of colonial rule in Canada, both Aboriginal people and Africans and their descendants were enslaved. From 1628 to 1833, slavery was a legal and acceptable institution in both French and British Canada and was vigorously practiced. So by the time she was writing, Mary was writing, and encouraging people to come up, there were no slaves, as slavery had been abolished by 1834. But that was only like 20 years earlier when she started writing and telling people to come up because, you know, you're a black man, you're free, and you can mm-hmm. do great things. But slavery was in Canada. We have a terrible history yeah. of it. And not to poo-poo on her work that she did, but it is important to note that we are not the beacon of hope that a lot of people, mm-mm. that we as Canadians like to push.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. Oh, something that I learned from reading the book was that as many enslaved people that were coming up to Canada for their freedom using the Underground Railroad, as many enslaved black people were actually using the same railroad to escape Canada and their enslavement. Oh, gosh. Nobody ever mentions that. So we had slaves, and they tried to get away from us, too. And they used the Underground Railroad. So, yeah, we're not all that great. We're not all that squeaky clean.
Yikes.
Never taught you that in history, did they?
No, they did not. Oh, dear.
And, yeah.
Ah. Wow.
So, of course, like, at the time that slavery was in practice, it was, Canada was not an actual country. They were colonies. Mm-hmm. That doesn't excuse anything. There was the British colony and there was the French colonies. And, of course, they were under the rule of France and Britain. And, of course, some people could say, well, then technically that's not Canada. Technically it's the colonies of England and France. So technically they had slaves. But no, we had slaves up here.
It's still the... It's still the fact of the matter is that is Canadian history mm-hmm. that continued past continued past independence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And has created the history of our, like, has created the, what am I trying to say? Basically, what I'm trying to say is Canada still does this shit yeah. all the time.
Yeah.
And so, while we could argue that it was a colony and therefore under British rule, mm-hmm. British and French rule, and so, like, technically, on a technical scale, yes, that wasn't Canada yet, yeah. but at the end of the day, it is those actions that have created the Canada of our present, mm-hmm. and Canada still does that shit. Mm-hmm. Canada is still on its shit.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah. It explains the terrible relations that we have mm-hmm. with Blacks and Aboriginals. So mm-hmm. Canada West, which was Ontario, New France, which was Quebec, and then New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, I believe PEI, those were the five, well, now provinces, but colonies at mm-hmm. that time, that had slavery and enslaved both Aboriginal and people of color and Blacks.
Mm-hmm.
So Canada is not squeaky clean, and despite
not at all.
Despite Mary's kind of like pamphleting, encouraging people to come up to Canada because it was, you know, a refuge from the people, only 20 years earlier, that would not have been the case. So good for her, good for all the work that she did, and she probably helped many people. but it was only 20 years earlier where that would not have been the case. And 20 or so years prior, when Angelique, the woman that I'm reading about now, was actually hung.
Oh, jeez.
And, like, there's a whole backstory as to why she was hung. She wasn't just hung because she was a black slave. But there was, like, a whole other thing. I'm not done reading it, but I'm definitely thinking of making it from the Dropbox simply because of the history that it shines on about enslavement in Canada. And I definitely think that that dirty little secret that we hold, we definitely need to be aired, and everybody needs to know. And I'm totally calling out our country on that, so.
I mean, I think that we need to do a whole episode just on calling out our country.
If you love your country, you will call them
out. Call it out. Yeah. If you love your country and want the best for it, you will be more than willing to call it out. And I think it's especially important for those of us who are born here to be doing that calling out. Because I feel like for a lot of new Canadians and a lot of people who emigrate here, here, that they are often seeking a better life. People don't often immigrate because they want a worse life. And they don't often immigrate because they want the same kind of life. Like, often there is something that is drawing them to the place. And it's quite easy to overlook the negativities, or to even understand the nuances and negativities of a country you're moving to, if you're moving there to escape something.
Yeah.
Right? Like, people who are immigrating here are not going to have the best idea or a strong idea about the Indigenous people of our country, because it's not advertised. Right? It's not taught. They wouldn't have been taught it because they didn't go to school here. Right? They wouldn't have any reason to think to look into it, because they're just trying to focus on getting a better life for themselves or their families. And so it's especially important for Canadians born here, or, you know, who moved here when they're very, very young, to be the ones to be like, Canada, you need to do better. And to hold them accountable, right, for both the Indigenous people who live here and the people who then decide to emigrate here because they feel like it's a better life.
It was actually funny because I was talking to somebody earlier this week, and I was telling them that I was reading this book. And I said that I enjoy reading history just because I feel like we need to learn from our past simply so that we don't repeat the mistakes that we've made. And in terms of slavery and all that, they said, well, I don't think that we would repeat that. I think we're all very kind now. And I was like, oh, bless you.
Oh, sweet summer child.
Such a beautiful, naive thought. But no, it's true. I mean, no, we're not enslaving people per se. You know, we definitely have moved away from that, but the undertones of racism and enslavement are all there. We still have a very big problem in terms of race and prejudices and systematic racism towards Indigenous and the Black people in Canada. And it stems from the fact that we have never recognized truly the terribly racist history that we have with the Black people. And we've never really kind of atoned for the racist and terrible treatment that we've committed against our Indigenous people.
Yeah.
So, no, we're not enslaving them the way that we used to, but we're not doing any better.
And also, slavery has evolved.
Oh, yes.
Right? Because people, so we might not be, you know, we not might not be holding people against their will and forcing them to work without any payment in individual homes. But we do that in prisons. Especially in the US. I'm not as up on Canadian prisons. It's something I need to be better. I need to educate myself better on. But I know that American prisons are privatized. And so they do make money off of the people in prison. And as Nora said, racism runs rampant. And so who is the primary... Which group of people primarily fill prisons? Well, young black people. Mm-hmm. For petty crimes. Mm-hmm. Or for multiple petty crimes. And so when you look at it from that perspective, is slavery over? Mm-hmm. Not really.
Yeah.
Slavery in name, maybe. Right? Like, you wouldn't call people in prison having to work because they're in prison slavery.
Right.
It doesn't look the same. It doesn't look like shackles and whips and people without a name.
Yeah.
But the practice is not dead, mm-hmm, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And so it's even more important that we discuss these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So once again, we highlighted some very accomplished people mm-hmm. of color from history to prove that during times of enslavement, that not every black person was enslaved, and they were accomplished and they did things and they were celebrated for them. Unfortunately, Emma's kind of, in Emma's person wasn't celebrated the yeah. way she really should have been. It was more of an attraction. Look at my black person who can write. Ooh, isn't she a yeah. marvel? But we can now, from today's perspective, recognize her and give her the due that she deserves, which is what we've done mm-hmm. today with her this podcast. Mm-hmm. We are giving her the props that she so greatly deserved. And, yeah.
And highlighting the inadequacies. Yes,
celebrating
that she faced.
The way that she should have been celebrated, because that is an accomplishment to be a published writer.
And I think especially to be able to write, like I read some of her poetry and it really was kind of a call out mm-hmm. to life, mm-hmm. especially to write those kind of things, knowing that you are an enslaved person. Yeah. And I didn't read it, but I can only imagine that her poetry would have first had to go through her enslaver mm-hmm. before he would probably bring it up to be published mm-hmm. on her behalf. Yeah. I can imagine that's probably how it would have gone, just given my knowledge of history. And so to write what she did, mm-hmm. knowing that her enslaver would first have to read it, no matter his affections for her,
yeah.
you know, whether he saw her as a child, like as one of his own children, kind of because he raised her with them mm-hmm. and they schooled together, or whether he did see her more as a kind of like as his slave kind of thing, but with some strange affection mm-hmm. in there. At the end of the day, like he still held power over her. Mm-hmm. And so for her to write is just an amazing thing anyway. Mm-hmm. And she definitely should have been able to live a life of honor and a life of
yeah.
of wealth because of her writing. Mm-hmm.
And it's actually very interesting to note that the two Alexanders, they were able to live very comfortably off their writings as mm-hmm. free men. And of course, there may have been some, you know, sexism involved in that as well, just the fact that they were mm-hmm. men, even if they were men of color, they probably were able to get by much better than a black woman that was then free. And of course, she probably didn't have the connections that they did as writers from the beginning who were publishing themselves
mm-hmm.
To actually be able to support herself in that way once she became free.
Yeah.
So two or three very different mm-hmm. examples. Well, four actually, because she was a writer as well. She was a journalist.
Yeah.
Four very different examples of black individuals making their way in the literary world and very mm-hmm. different outcomes. Some very tragic, some very noble and proud. Mm-hmm. And I know lots of people still read the books of The Count of Monte Cristo and The Three Musketeers. Yeah. So.
And The Count of Monte Cristo has had heavy influence on the pop culture mm-hmm. industry. So it's really amazing to be able to find out the history of that.
Yeah.
And of course, we want you all to share maybe your favorite black author mm-hmm. and any person of color that you think we should do a dive into their history
yes.
and discuss their lives. I think it'd be really important.
Yeah. And if you...
Which actually... Oops, you finish.
And if you have any recommendations for us that you think we should highlight in our From the Dropbox series, let us know. We will definitely take a look at them and Mm-hmm. Give them an ad and a plug if we feel that they are worthy.
Mm-hmm. And that actually leads me, I want to start doing some housekeeping at the end of our episodes mm-hmm. before we say goodbye. So if you don't already, please subscribe to us on whatever place you listen to your podcasts. Mm-hmm. We should be anywhere, Spotify, iTunes, Podcast Republic, and many others. Also, please check us out on our social media at overdue.thepodcast on pretty much any social media. Mm-hmm. We're not on Twitter, but we'll get there.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah, those are our two most navigated mm-hmm. platforms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and please reach out to us also any way you want. We love to hear from you all, and you know, we want to interact more with our audience. Mm-hmm. So from me, Emma.
And me, Nora.
We'll see you next time.